Mr. Holdsworth, Rail 5. So you were just about to say about taking the commander. You were about to say about when you took the commandos over to Malaya. Can I
Yeah.
just ask before you talk about what happened? There were a fair number of national servicemen going over during that period. To actually fight there. And they were saying that when they were sent over, they tended to be told what they were doing in during the Second World War, when they introduced all this education course stuff in the army. They, particularly with national servicemen, tended to at least have the pretense of discussing what was going on. And they were told, rather than giving them a very crude sort of world communism conspiracy type bit of bullshit, they tended to talk more about specifically what the CTs, as they called them, were doing, and by implication the Chinese through that. So for example, they'd give horror stories about how they were terrorizing the villages and how we were going out there to defend these innocent villages and the plantation owners and people like that from these terrorists, rather than, as I say, a sort of crude anti-communist thing, because obviously, there was a fair amount of sympathy generally for communism at the time. What were you told you were going there for?
We weren't told anything. We were just told we were taking these Royal Marine Commandos. They were part of the war, that was going on in Malaya with the communists. And of course, we'd been in the North Korean War, so presumably they reckon we were sacked up, No, they never bothered. We just picked them up in Hong Kong. They came aboard and they squashed in. And we sailed off.
How many of them were you carrying?
I'm not too sure. I can't remember the figures. There was nearly as many as the ship's company, and there was 900.
So you were pretty cramped.
Oh, I were very, very cramped. They were sleeping on the upper deck. On the steel decks. They give them a sheet to cover themselves with. It was fairly warm. But we went through the Malacca Straits and we hit two typhoons going through, and it really threw it down. And these buggers were, sleeping on the upper deck with these bloody sheets. Something went through, toughening them up, supposedly.
You think that it was deliberate then?
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised, yes. Because they all had this bullshit about being commandos, Royal Marine commandos, you see. It wasn't sufficient to be a Royal Marine, you were a Royal Marine commando, the creme de creme sort of rubbish that they fed them all. And they were real tough characters, no doubt about it. And we saw later, how hardened they were. Because when we got to Penang,
Before you get onto that, was that the impression they made then? Of being sort of pretty brutal characters.
Tough.
I'm talking about when you met them. Did you get the impression they'd been brutalised at all, or did they just have that sort of bravado?
No, they were tough, hard lads,
So they
I didn't see them as brutal. I mean, they were just ordinary.
But did they seem different to you? Was there a sense
Tough and hard,
that, in
yeah,
that sense,
yeah.
did you feel? Because presumably you yourselves considered yourselves very tough. You must have sort of.
No, we thought
a
we
bit
were
more.
just ordinary.
Did you?
Yeah. We were just ordinary. I
There
mean,
wasn't
boozy
a plan.
matlows. Not all of us fit, We were fairly fit. We were only 20s. But
But there was no sort of pride of being tough and
no,
hard or
no,
anything like that.
no. There was a contingent on the ship, did muscle boats and Charles Atlas and stuff. But they were only a minority. No. There was no. Fitness. Well, we were all the age where you didn't need to do. Be fit, you were fit at that age, weren't you? I mean, it was a fairly healthy regime, the Navy, sort of. It was an active, fresh air life and a stable diet, sort of thing. With occasional, flashes ashore, but they were a minority of the time, surely.
I just meant really that obviously you're going to be physically fit. I didn't mean sort of hardness in that way. I meant, did you sort of get the impression from your mates on the ship and so on that there was something different about these blokes?
They were tough buggers. In their outlook, they were tough buggers.
So yeah. It was more of a sort of attitude than anything, was it?
Yeah, they were tough. Aye.
What do you mean by that? Like, can you sort of explain what you mean? How did it come across when you
fit met? And hard, you know, very physical. They were very physical.
What do you mean?
Well, they were very physical. You know, they were tough. How can you describe it?
They just made it obvious in their sort of demeanour generally.
Yeah.
So anyway, you were taking them along.
Yeah, we took them to Penang and we offloaded them in Penang. And they notified the ship's company then, officially, with the official channels, that they thanked us for our hospitality, because we'd mucked in with them, you know, they had meals with us and all that. And apart from the sleeping quarters, I mean, we were very, very cramped. It was uncomfortable on the ship for that period. And we'd had a tough voyage, you know, as I said, the typhoon through the Malacca Straits, which were rough at the best of times.
Did the commandos suffer seasickness?
Yes, quite a few of them.
Were they embarrassed about that?
They were just generally miserable. When you're seasick, you're not embarrassed. You want to die, you know. You don't give a shit what anybody else is thinking about it. You just want to die somewhere as soon as possible. But they thanked us for our hospitality and said that to return it, you know, we could volunteer to go with them on the patrol, see what their life was like. They'd seen ours, and we could see what theirs was.
Had they been out there already?
No. So, but apparently it was the, you know, the powers that be thought it would be a good idea, presumably. So we went by train, and it was outside Kuala Lumpur. And we went on this patrol, this, us three, again, Bertie Bell, McLaughlin, myself. They fitted us up with the uniforms, you know, this jungle thing. And we went with them, I mean, what bloody
use?
What
sort of gear was that you were wearing? What sort of stuff?
You know, jungle uniform sort of stuff.
What?
The, you know, the camouflage stuff and all that. And, well, greenish it was. And the soft hat. What use we'd have been, I don't know. But we were there as passengers anyway, you know. And it was all, you know, going through the jungle, sort of all romantic sort of stuff. But then they said, oh, we're going to this village where they'll be giving aid to the communists. We're going to discipline them. Well, we had no idea what it was. Anyway, the sergeant and that went on ahead. And when we got to the village, they got these two headmen, they said were headmen, and tied them to this palm tree, you know, coconut tree. And they had them tied back to back. And they lined the villagers up. And they were speaking to them in the language, you know. And they slit the stomachs with these matchets, you know, these like big knife things. Slit the stomach and all their intestines came out. And as they were there all steaming and all that, and these people dropped unconscious, you know, they marched all the village past. And Bertie Bell had taken along his camera. It was an old Ensign Selfix, you know, one of them you pull out. And he took some photos of this. Because we were horrified. It was like, I mean, I had been home on leave when they showed the concentration camp films. And I saw it in Ashton at the pavilion. And they put troops from the local barracks on the exits. And you weren't allowed to go out. You had to stop and watch it, you see. When they freed Belsen. Book involved in that. And
when you say that, did people have to go and see these films then?
No. But they said this was coming on, this news of the freeing of the Belsen concentration camp, where his soldiers had freed it. And they felt that we had to see it. And so soldiers were stationed on the doorstep to prevent people leaving.
Who made that decision? Was that just
the authorities, apparently?
The army authorities, or the...
No, the government authorities, I presume. And, I mean, it was done in all the cinemas, apparently. And it was Jane Eyre, the film. This was like the news. I went with my auntie. And we thought, you know, these were atrocities. And this was an atrocity that these buggers were doing. It was, you know, we thought, it's not British sort of thing. You know, little did we know, you know, that we sort of couldn't go along with it, you know. And we showed our disgust of the thing.
What did you do?
Well, we told them, you know.
What did you say? Can you remember?
No, we said it wasn't British, you know.
Did you say that?
Yeah.
And what was their reaction? Did they think you were naive?
Yeah. They sort of... they said, well, you know, you're fighting a war. Unless you can stop these giving sustenance to the guerrillas, then, you know, they're going to kill some of us. So...
And this exchange took place on the spot?
On the patrol, yeah.
Whilst this was going on?
After it had gone on.
After, you were talking afterwards.
Yeah.
So what did you do at the time? You just sort of stood and watched?
Yeah, we stood and watched.
And what was their attitude when they did it? Was it very matter-of-fact?
Very matter-of-fact, yeah.
So did you get the impression they'd done this sort of thing before then?
Yeah.
Although they hadn't actually been to Malaya.
Well, I don't know whether the NCOs had been.
I see.
You see? Mm-hmm. But,
and it was them who did it. It was the officers.
Yeah.
They were the ones who could speak the language in Malaya. But the other soldiers
thought nothing about it. Yeah. It was a necessary sort of thing.
So when you spoke to them, when you had this conversation about it not being right to do it, did they imply in any way that they did this kind of thing normally? Or?
Well, they said it was part of the, you know, the techniques.
So they'd actually been trained?
Yeah, to do stuff like this. Must have been. And they didn't think bugger all of it. And we said, well, you know, we didn't consider it was civilised, you know, British, this type of thing. We certainly couldn't go along with this type of thing. In fact, what was all this thing with the Germans about? You know, if it was wrong for them to do stuff like this, to civilians, I mean, what the bloody hell were these doing it for? You know, you can't have one rule for one and another for another. I mean, we didn't go along with it, Bertie and I. And anyway, when we got back to the ship, they must have been told, because they sent for Bell and took his films off him, you know, so we'd no proof of the thing.
Did they offer any explanation about why they were taken?
No, they said it was official secrets. So it was just taken off him, you know. And we discussed it all on the ship. You know, we told them all what these bastards were doing out there. And the ship's company, the ones we talked to, felt the same way as us, you know. And that was it was like us seeing the Americans treating the prisoners like that. I mean, we didn't go on it, we were horrified. I mean, okay, you know, they've been fighting on the other side, but so bloody what? Well, it's instinctive as well. You start doing that to them, and they capture you, what are they going to do to you? I mean, it's ludicrous. That's what we felt anyway.
So when you were talking to these soldiers, they were justifying what they were doing on the grounds that they were doing the same sort of things.
Yeah.
Because as I said before, when I mentioned that some of these national servicemen...
Oh, they said that the guerrillas were doing all sorts of stuff, you know.
Because that is...
They were having to protect some of these, villages.
Because what you see, when I said before about the national servicemen getting this indoctrination, it seems very much that they were being told... The reason they were being told about atrocities was, you know, deliberately, because they knew they were going to be seeing these things themselves to justify that happening.
Mm.
Have you ever wondered why your own training didn't seem to involve any sort of brutalisation at all in the Navy?
It's long distance, the Navy. I mean, you're at sea and your guns are long distance. It's not, you don't have, you have rifles on ships, but I mean, when do you use them? When you're going, taking another ship. So you fire at each other at long range. I mean, 6-inch shells go about 89 miles. It was quite a good way. We were firing over this mountain, you know, to the front lines, you know, when we're in the south. So there's no real call to indoctrinate the Navy on things like that.
I gather that the commandos particularly were it became like a sort of a bit of a tradition, this kind of behaviour out in Malaya, and they were actually offered cans of beer for the people who made the most kills and this kind of thing. So it seemed like, you know, it was pretty widespread. This
And they had the people from Borneo as well, didn't they? The Dayaks, who were head hunters sort of people.
Working with them.
Yeah.
You mentioned before that seeing this kind of thing and actually, like for example, the experience of the prisoners that you took in the Korean campaign, made you begin to sort of think a bit about what was going on, why you were actually there.
I became more open-minded.
Did you? Was this a common experience? Were you talking to people about this, or were you just thinking yourself?
Yeah, certainly my you know, immediate periphery of people were quite open-minded. I know later when I became a communist, the same people, Bertie and McLaughlin and a few of the mates, I mean, I had no objections to it.
You know. Was it normal for... you said that when you started out in the Navy as boys, I mean, obviously you're young boys and you wouldn't be talking much about these kind of things anyway, but you said that you gave the impression anyway that you kept yourself to yourself in one sense, in that you didn't really talk a lot about things beyond your immediate sort of day-to-day life. At that time, was that still the case when you were out in the Navy, or would you have felt free to speak your mind about things like that?
Yeah.
Or would you have been seen as a bit odd, not necessarily ostracised, but just seen as a bit odd for starting to question that kind of thing?
No, I don't think so. No, we had all sorts of arguments about all sorts of things. You know, all sorts of things. Questioning everything, religion, you know, the lot. There wasn't much politics. They didn't understand politics at all. Because we had no tradition. We joined up as boys, lot of us, and, you know, so you'd missed all the political traditions that you get in the working class.
But what about the older men and say, the HOs? Did none of them talk about these things? Presumably, some of the HOs at least would have had some sort of...
Oh, they must have been. I mean, during the war you had the Cairo Parliament and so on. I never came across any. Well, I was, unless I wasn't aware of them, I wasn't aware of politics being talked at all.
When did you become aware of politics?
Well, when I met my wife, you know, girlfriend as she then was.
When was that?
We'd come back, decommissioned the Jamaica.
This is after?
Yeah.
After the Malayan?
Yeah.
So what date was this? Can you remember how old
50.
You were then?
It was about 20 odd. Right. And we decommissioned and then came on 6 weeks leave. And it was during the 6 weeks leave that I met her. She worked in the tobacconist.
This was back in Ashton, was it?
Yeah.
Did you always come back home when you were on leave?
Yeah.
Was that because you had nowhere else to go?
Nowhere else to go.
And no money, so?
Well, you had a reasonable amount of money.
But you wouldn't have been able to afford to, say, go to London?
No.
And you wouldn't have felt any inclination?
You wouldn't have dreamt of going there. You immediately went straight home, you know. And, I sort of, I went for some cigarettes and met her. Asked her out, and I think we'd been out a few times, and we went out to Marple Lakes, and I was in the uniform and made a real fool of myself rowing this boat, kept falling in the back. We'd been used to row pulling on a cutter's oar, you know, a big 16-foot oar, where you have to put your weight behind it, and when you start on the little, I was, you know, straight in the back, and Elsie then swapped over, and she did this real professional job, floating the oars on the surface of the water, feathering them, you know, in a return stroke, and pulled to the side, and quite a lot of people around the lake, they're all Roman lakes, have been watching me making a fool of myself. So I was glad to get out of the bloody boat. Yeah. Anyway, when we got out, she just said this, I don't know why she brought it up, she just said, oh, she was a communist. Right? So I was quite intrigued by this, you know. I mean, not just a pretty face sort of thing. And so I immediately wanted to know all about it. So it was towards the latter end of my leave. Anyway, I went back to the ship and she started, you know, sending me things like Soviet Weekly, Soviet Bloody Weekly. And I used to read it, all these Vyshinsky speeches. I used to read Vyshinsky's speeches to the people in the mess deck, you know, in Drake. Anyway, I got drafted up
what
to...
What did they make of that? Did they think you'd gone mad or something?
I don't know.
What was their reaction to hearing his speeches?
I used to make fiery speeches about the blood of the bosses, you know, running in the gutters and all that. I don't know, I had a bit of support. Anyway, I was moved up to a ship called the Buchaness, a tank landing ship. It was a reserve fleet up the Clyde, up at Gaelic Head, near Islandsborough. And with a number of ships up there, KG-5, an aircraft carrier that somebody had made and had been refused by the Navy. It was later turned into one of these helicopter ships, the Defence, I think they called it, a Tiger or some other thing. Its flight deck was warped, that was why they'd refused it. And we started there. And the officers gradually became aware of me. We had this thing with the parson. When the king died, was it the king died? Couldn't have been. Anyway, this parson was coming out with something, and I caught his eye, and, you know, smiled, you hypocritical bastard. Because then I'd read Fraser's Golden Bough. Before I got interested in communism, I'd dumped religion. I read Fraser's Golden Bough, you know, and had seen through it. And so I was sneering at him, and he must have reported it. And I was read the Articles of War. And then they started picking on me for things, like white socks.
How soon was this after you'd met Elsie?
Not all that long after.
So you very quickly started to change your views.
I'd bought some books from Plymouth. From progressive books there, Lenin's Works, and Marx, Wage Labour Capital, and so on. And so I was in. And
did you understand them when you read them?
Yeah, yeah. Rostin's History of the USSR. Well, What Is to Be Done, and that was about the Russians. And it was part of Russian history. It wasn't. Living politics, because I had no means of relating it to living politics, but it was what type of part is necessary and so on. And State and Revolution was what type of party and organisation is necessary for a revolution, you see. Took it for granted the CP would be for Soviets. And so I used to argue with the ship's company and get a few supporters. Anyway, they had me up on a charge, and they tried to widen it.
And this was the first sort of real brush you'd had, with authority?
And then they dropped it, and then they started another tactic.
What charge did they press to begin with?
I forget what it was now.
What was the gist of it anyway?
It was insubordination. Insubordination sort of thing.
Just for that, giving the... passing that.
Yeah. And then I'd been on shore patrol and we're in the police station in Helensburgh and I was arguing communism with these and I was suddenly conscious all the police station had gone very quiet.
Why were you in the police station?
Well, that's where the shore patrol went, you know, in between patrolling. And I was suddenly conscious of all the police station gone very quiet, you see. So then they used to arrest me. Just before I'm reaching for my tot, times and they did arrest me, take me down to cells, hold me for about a quarter of an hour, marched me up on the quarterdeck. All the hands were fell in, off caps. They'd read the articles of war, then dismissed. Then they'd let me go.
And this started happening frequently?
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah. 2 or 3 times a week. And people must have been taking reports down of what I was saying and everything, you know. And then I was drafted back to barracks, back to Devonport. And I was put in the barrack guard, which is a privileged position, see there. I was also on RN shooting team, see. So I was in the barrack guard.
Why did they put you on that, do you think? Do you think
an eye on me.
You don't think they were trying to sort of, tempt you away from...
No. I think I was under surveillance, yeah. Best that way. And this officer said, oh, of course, he was a Bolshie, you know, and I'd sort of been very dismissive of him. But he was obviously a provocateur, you know, he was provocative and so on.
People were telling you this officer was a Bolshie?
No. He said it to me. Because I was arguing with everybody, you know. And about the Soviet Union. I was arguing with everybody about it. And then they arrested me.
This was the second time you've been arrested.
We were trying to form a trade union as well.
Can I just... So, before you talk about this, when you... You obviously, by now, you were thinking of yourself as a communist.
Yeah.
First of all, why didn't you leave the Navy?
Well, you couldn't leave the Navy. I was a regular.
So there was no way of getting out?
No, I was stuck in it.
So you sort of viewed it sort of fatalistically, really, that you were in there and you had to do something.
Yeah, and let's face it, the Bolsheviks operated in the forces. And so I was trying to get a cell. So
you, from that point of view, you were actually trying to organise something within the Navy.
Yeah.
That's what you saw your role as being, to try and do something.
Yeah.
So what did you try and do?
Well, first of all, I started using the complaints procedure. Anything wrong with the meals, I'd complain and see the Admiral, Commodore in this case, Commodore S.
So you saw basically your role as defending the conditions of the...
Agitating. That's what I had to agitate. Get people discontent. Things.
Were you aware, when you started doing this, of any tradition of lower deck organisation?
No.
Had you ever heard of things like Invergordon?
Yes. Coming home on the Jamaica, I'd got a book from the ship's library by a captain RN on the mutiny at Invergordon.
And this was before you'd met Elsa?
Yep. I'd read that, which was quite impressive.
What did you think of that then?
I thought it was quite impressive.
Were you surprised by it?
Yes. And I was impressed with the way they'd organised. And quite excited by it. It was an exciting story, you know. Although they were defeated, inevitably. But, so I thought, well, what we want is a trade union, first of all.
Why did you say inevitably they were defeated?
Well, because they'd nowhere to go. It was just a strike. I mean, they weren't trying to overthrow the authorities or anything.
But when you read it, did you think then it was inevitable they'd be defeated? Or did you think that by just organising strikes you could get something?
Yes, I thought then by organising strikes you could get something.
So at the time you didn't see it as inevitable?
I didn't see it as inevitable, no. No, because of course it didn't appear that. It was just a... The fact that they were defeated was just this sort of the nasty officer class, you know, tricked them.
So anyway, you then decided that you were going to try and do something.
And Bertie Bell and McLaughlin were in barracks at the time, so I met them and we were talking about it. And we were putting feelers out, and there was quite a lot of support, you know, for the idea. And Hannon Swaffer had done something from the people. Had commented on the conditions in Plymouth Barracks at the end of the war, the 48s and so on. And it was like Risley is today.